Certain attorneys were arguing that they must move to a higher vision of what they do, that they must understand the true role of lawyers, to reduce conflict, not promote it. Similarly, several of the temples we saw were looking at the situation of political corruption in various countries. We saw scenes of elected officials in Washington, D.C., debating behind closed doors as to whether to support campaign finance reform. At issue, most especially, was the ability of political parties to receive unlimited amounts of contributions from special interests and spend it on general TV spots, which distorted the truth in any manner they wished. This dependence on large corporations for these funds obviously obligated the politicians of the party to certain favors, and everyone knew it. These politicians resisted the arguments of reformers that democracy could never reach its ideal until it was based not on distorted TV ads, but on public debates, where citizens could more readily judge demeanor, facial expression, and truthfulness, and thus use their intuition to choose the best candidate. As we continued to move through the temples, it became clear that all of them were similarly focused on some particular area of human life. We saw many fearful world leaders, including those in the Chinese government, being helped to join the global community and to implement economic and social reforms. And in every case, the area behind the people involved would lighten, and then those most in fear who were acting to control or manipulate to ensure personal gain or power would gradually begin to lessen the intractability of their positions. As we continued to run through the maze of temples searching for Tashi's grandmother, the same questions kept coming to me. What exactly was happening here? What was the relationship between the Dakini, or the angels, and the prayer extensions being performed? What did those in the temples know that we didn't? At one point, we stood facing literally miles of temples as far as we could see. The paths were going in every direction. In the background, we could still hear the helicopters. As we stood there, another large temple 500 feet behind us came crashing to the ground. "What's happening to the people inside those temples?" I asked Tashi. He stared at the plume of dust rising from the rubble. "Don't worry. They're all right. They can move into another location without being seen. The problem is that their role of sending energy is being disrupted." He looked at both of us. "If they aren't able to help with these situations, who's going to?" Will walked over to Tashi. "We have to decide where to go. We don't have much time." "My grandmother is out there somewhere," he said. "My father told me she is at one of the central temples." I looked down at the maze of stone structures. "There is no physical center, not that I can see." "That's not what my father meant," Tashi said. "He meant that grandmother is at a temple that is focused on the central endpoint issues of human evolution." Tashi was surveying the temples in the distance as he spoke. "You can see the people here better than us," I said to him. "Could you talk to them and ask them where to go?" "I tried to talk to them," he replied, "but my energy isn't strong enough. Possibly, if I was able to stay here for a little while." Tashi had no sooner finished his sentence than another temple crashed to the ground, this time much closer. "We have to stay ahead of the soldiers' energy," Will said. "Wait a minute," Tashi said. I think I see something." He was looking out toward the maze of temples. I surveyed the scene as well, seeing nothing different. When I glanced at Will, he shrugged. "Where?" I asked Tashi. He was already walking down a pathway to the right, motioning for us to follow. After hurriedly walking for 20 minutes, we stopped in front of a temple whose architecture was much the same as all the others, except that it was larger, and its dark brown rock carried a slightly bluer hue. Tashi stood motionless, looking directly at the massive stone door. "What is it, Tashi?" Will asked. Far behind us, we heard a crash as yet another temple collapsed. Tashi looked over at me. "The temple, in your dream. The one where you said we found someone. Wasn't it blue? I looked at the temple again, a chill rushing through me. Yeah, I said, it was. Will walked toward the door and looked back at us. Tashi nodded, and Will swung the huge rock slab back on its hinges. The temple was filled with people. As before, I could only see the slight outlines of many bodies. They all seemed to be moving, gathering around us, and I felt awash in a distinct feeling of joy. They were moving in a way that gave me the impression that they were turning toward the center of the temple. Turning that way myself, I saw a spatial window open. We began to see various scenes in the Middle East, followed by images from the Vatican, then Asia, all seemingly indicating a growing dialogue between the major institutional religions. We watched scenes that showed how an increased tolerance was developing. In Christianity, in both the Catholic and Protestant traditions, it was becoming understood that the true conversion experience within Christianity and the true devotional and enlightenment experiences of the Eastern religions, Judaism and Islam, the experience itself, were exactly the same. It was just that each religion emphasized different aspects of this mystical interaction with God. The Eastern religions emphasized the effects on consciousness itself, the experience of lightness, a sense of oneness with the universe, the release of the ego's desires, and a certain detachment. Islam emphasized the feeling of unity that came with sharing this experience with others, and the power inherent in group action. Judaism emphasized the importance of a tradition based on this connection, of the experience of feeling chosen, and that each person alive is responsible for pushing forward the evolution of human spirituality. Christianity was emphasizing the idea that the spirit manifests in human beings, not just as an increased awareness of being part of God, but also as a higher self, as though we become an expanded version of who we are, more complete, capable, with an inner guidance and wisdom leading us to act as if the human personality of God, the Christ, was now looking through our eyes. In the scene before us, we could see the effects of this new tolerance and unity. More and more, the focus was being placed on the experience of the connection itself, not on differences of emphasis. There seemed to be a growing willingness to resolve ethnic and religious conflicts, a greater communication between religious leaders, and a new understanding of how powerful prayer could be, if all extended their fields in religious unity. As I watched, I understood fully what Lama Rigdon and Ani had both said about the unification of religion, that this would be a sign that the secrets of Shambhala were becoming known. At that point, the scene through the window in front of us changed. We could see a group of people talking and joyously celebrating the birth of a baby. Everyone was laughing and passing the infant from one person to another. The people looked to be different from each other, representing various nationalities. As I watched, I got the distinct impression that they represented different religious backgrounds as well. As I looked closely, I could see the parents of the baby. They looked familiar. I knew it was not them, but the parents' facial features were very similar to Pima's and her husband's. I strained to see, getting the feeling that we were not being shown something of immense importance. What was it? The scene changed again, and we were now looking at a tropical region which looked like Southeast Asia, or perhaps China. As before, the scene shifted into a house where a number of people, diverse in appearance, were taking turns holding a newborn and toasting the parents. "Don't you see what we're being shown?" Tashi said. "That's where the missing conceptions were going. They were moving to different families all over the world. It must have been a channeling process. Somehow the children were gaining the higher genetic energy of Shambhala before moving on." Will was looking down, thinking. Then he stared back at us. "That's the shift," he said. "That's what the legends have been talking about. Shambhala's not moving to one place. its energy is moving to many different locations all over the globe.
What?
I asked. Tashi looked over at me. You know the legend that says the warriors of Shambhala will stream out of the east and defeat the powers of darkness and create an ideal society. This isn't happening with horses and swords. It's happening with the effect of our extended fields as the knowledge of Shambhala moves into the world. If all those from every religion who believe strongly in a connection with the divine avoid negative prayer and work together, we can all use the prayer extensions to take over the role of Shambhala.
But we don't know everything they're doing, I said. We don't know the rest of the secret.
Just as I said that, the scene through the spatial window changed again. Now we could see a great expanse of snow-covered mountains and a group of Chinese military helicopters heading towards us. We saw more temples begin to crumble to the ground as they approached, taking on the appearance of ancient ruins and then fading away altogether to dust. The scene switched to the outside of the very building where we were, and then inside. We saw ourselves standing in the building, and all around us were not hazy outlines of people, but clear pictures of them. Many were adorned in the formal attire of Tibetan monks, but many others were dressed differently. Some appeared in the clothing of the Eastern religions, others wore the traditional attire of Hasidic Jews, and still others wore the robes and carried the crucifixes of Christianity, just as many were dressed as Islamic priests. Interestingly, one of them reminded me of a person living near my house in the valley, and my eyes lingered on her. I slipped into a daydream about home. In my mind's eye, I could see everything very clearly. The mountains viewed from my front window, and then the same view from the spring. I thought of the taste of the water there. I pictured myself leaning over and drinking. Again we could hear the roar of the helicopters, very near to us, and the sound of one of the other temples crashing to the ground. Tashi had turned away and walked over to our right. In the scene through the spatial window, we could see what he was doing. Tashi was facing one of the Tibetan monks.
Who is that? I asked Will.
It must be his grandmother, Will replied. They were clearly speaking to each other, but I couldn't quite understand the words. Finally, the two embraced and Tashi rushed over to us. I was still watching Tashi through the window, but when he reached me, the scene disappeared. The window was still there, but the images within it were fuzzy, like a television set tuned to a non-existent channel. Tashi was glowing.
Don't you see, he said,
this is the temple where they have been watching you and Will the whole time you were trying to reach Shambhala. These people are the ones who have been using their prayer field to help you. Without them, none of us would be here. I looked around and realized I could no longer see the outlines of anyone around us.
Where did they go? I yelled.
They had to leave, Tashi replied, now staring up at the empty window hovering in the center of the room. It's up to us now. At that moment, a huge shock reverberated through the temple, and several stones thudded to the ground outside.
It's the soldiers, Tashi yelled. They are here.
He was looking toward the sound of the helicopters outside. Without warning, the spatial window cleared, and we could see the Chinese getting out of their helicopters right outside. Colonel Chang walked to the front, giving directions to his troops. We could see his face clearly.
We've got to uplift them with our fields, Will said.
Tashi nodded in agreement and quickly led us through the extensions. We visualized our energy fields overflowing out of us and into the fields of the Chinese soldiers, especially Chang, lifting them to a new awareness of their higher intuitions. As I watched his face, he seemed to pause and look up, as if sensing the higher energy. I looked closely for any expression of his higher self and noticed what seemed to be a slight shift in his eyes, maybe even a half smile. He seemed to be looking around at his soldiers.
Focus on his face, I said, on his face.
As we did this, he seemed to pause again. One of the soldiers, apparently next in command, walked up to him and began asking him questions. For a moment or two, Chang ignored the junior officer.
But slowly, the subordinate gained his attention, pointing at the temple we were in. Chang seemed to regain his focus, and an angry expression returned to his face. He motioned for all the soldiers to follow him as he headed toward us. "It's not working," I said. Will looked at me. "The Dakini aren't here." "We have to leave," Tashi shouted.
"How?" Will asked.
Tashi turned to face us. "We have to go through the window. My grandmother told me that we could leave through the window to the outer cultures, but only if we had help from that location to raise the energy on the other side."
"What did she mean, help?" I asked. "Who would help?"
Tashi shook his head. "I don't know."
"Well, we've got to try," Will shouted. "Now!"
Tashi appeared confused.
"How did you go through the windows back in the outer rings?" I asked.
"We had the amplifiers back there," he replied. "I'm not sure I can do it without them."
I touched Tashi's shoulder.
Ani said that everyone in the rings was on the verge of being able to manifest without the technology.
"Think! How did you do it?"
Tashi was still struggling.
"I don't know, really. It was sort of automatic."
He paused.
"I guess we just expected it to occur, and it would happen instantly."
"Do that, Tashi," Will said, nodding toward the window. "Do it now." I could tell Tashi was concentrating totally, and then he looked at me.
"I have to know where I want to go so I can visualize it. Where are we supposed to go?"
"Wait a minute," I said. "What about the dream you had? Weren't you seeing water?"
Tashi thought for a moment, then said, "It was a place overlooking a source of water. A well, maybe, or a spring," I shouted. "A spring with a walled-off pool made of stone?"
He stared at me for a moment.
"I think so."
I looked at Will.
"I know where it is. It's a spring on the north ridge of the valley where I live. That's where we have to go."
At that moment, the temple shook violently again. Images of the temple collapsing or explosions blowing us away filled my mind, and I shook them off, imagining instead that we would escape. I began to feel like my father, caught in a battle I had not asked for, but because of the stakes, was unable to avoid. Only it was a battle of the mind.
"Focus!" I yelled. "What do we do?"
"We first have to visualize where we are going," Tashi replied.
"Describe it to us."
Hastily, I told them every detail. The mountain path, the trees, the way the water flowed, the color of the foliage this time of year. Then we all tried to help as Tashi concentrated on the image. As we watched, the window shifted to that very sight. We could see the spring clearly.
"That's it," I shouted.
Will turned to Tashi.
"Now what? Your grandmother said we would need help."
Through the window, we caught sight of a person in the background, and we all focused on the fuzzy image. I struggled to make out who it was, noticing that the individual looked young, in fact, about Tashi's age. Finally, the picture cleared, and I recognized who it was.
"It's Natalie, my neighbor's daughter," I shouted, remembering my first intuition of her. It was of this scene.
Tashi was smiling broadly.
"That's my sister."
At that moment, another huge piece of the temple crashed to the ground outside.
"She's helping us," Will yelled, pushing us all toward the window. "Let's go."
With a swooshing sound, Tashi ducked through, followed by Will. Just as I approached the window, the back wall of the temple fell in, and there, on the other side, stood Colonel Chang. I turned and glanced at him, then moved into the window. His face was still determined as he grabbed a shortwave radio off his belt.
"I know where you're going," he shouted as the rest of the temple began to fall in. "I know!"
When I stepped through the window, my foot landed on familiar soil, and I felt the warm air on my face. I was back at home. As I looked around, I noticed that Tashi and Natalie were standing together, looking into each other's eyes, talking rapidly. Their faces were elated, as though they had just discovered something. Will stood by their side. Behind them,
was Natalie's father, Bill, and several other neighbors from around the community, including Father Brannigan and Sri Devo and Julie Carmichael, a Protestant minister. All of them looked slightly confused. Bill walked over to me. "I don't know where you came from, but thank God you're here." I pointed toward the clerics. "What is everyone doing here?" "Natalie asked them to come. She's been talking about legends and showing us how to create prayer fields, all sorts of things. Apparently these ideas have just been coming to her. She said she could see what was happening to you, and we've been seeing someone watching your house." I looked up the hill and was about to say something when Bill interrupted. "Natalie also said something strange. She said she had a brother. Who's that kid she's talking to?" "I'll explain later," I said. "Who has been watching my house?" Bill didn't answer. He was watching as Will and the others were walking up to us. At that moment, we heard vehicles approaching on the hill above us. A blue van pulled up to my house. Two men got out, saw us, and walked out to an overhang 100 feet above us. "They're Chinese intelligence," Will said. "Chang must have alerted them. We have to create a field." I was expecting the clerics to ask what that was, but instead they nodded in agreement. Natalie began to lead us through the extensions, Tashi at her side. "Begin with the energy of the Creator," she said. "Let it come into your body and fill you up. Let it flow out the top of your head and through your eyes. Let it flow out into the world in a constant prayer field until you see only beauty and feel only love. In a heightened alertness, expect this field to move out and boost the spiritual fields of the men above us, raising them into their intuitions." Up on the hill, the men stared ominously and started down the path toward us. Tashi looked over at Natalie and nodded. "Now," Natalie began, "we can empower the angels." I glanced at Will. "What?" "First," Natalie continued, "we must make sure our fields are fully set to enter the fields of the men up there. See it happening. They aren't enemies. They're people, souls in fear. And then we must acknowledge the angels fully and very deliberately visualize them coming to the men. Then, with all your expectations, visualize them amplifying their prayer fields. Empower the angels fully to energize the higher selves of those men beyond what we can do alone, uplifting the men into an awareness that is incapable of evil." I was staring at the two men on the hill, searching for the lighter area that would indicate the presence of the Dakini, struggling to focus, but seeing nothing. "It's not working," I said to Will. "Look," he shouted, "up there, to the right." As I stared, I began to detect a light approaching, then noticed that the light was surrounding a person who was walking toward the two men. The man surrounded by the light had on the uniform of a deputy sheriff. "Who is that officer?" I asked Bill. "He looks familiar." "Wait," Will said. "It's not a person." I looked again and watched as the deputy began to talk with the two men. The light surrounded them, and they finally walked back toward their vehicle. Although the deputy remained where he was, the light extended out to them and surrounded the van. They quickly left. "The extension worked," Will said. I wasn't really listening. My eyes were focused on the deputy who had turned toward us. He was tall and had black hair. Where had I seen him before? It came to me as he turned and walked away. This was the same man I had seen at the pool in Kathmandu, the one who had first told me about the prayer research, the one I had glimpsed on several other occasions. "They've always posed as humans when necessary," Tashi said, walking up to me with Natalie. "We have just completed the last extension," Tashi added. "We finally know the secret of Shambhala. We can now begin to perform as those in Shambhala have done. They have looked out on the world and found key situations that were occurring and then interceded with not only the strength of their own prayer field, but the strength of the angelic realms as well. This is the role of the angels, to amplify.
I don't understand, I said. Why didn't it work when we tried to stop Chang just before we came through the window?
I didn't know the last step, Tashi said. I didn't realize what those in the temples were doing until I could talk to Natalie. We had been uplifting Chang, which was necessary, but we didn't know to empower the angelic forces to come in on our energy and intervene. We have to begin with acknowledging the angels, but then, at this level of energy, we have to empower them to act. We must do this very intentionally. We must ask them to come.
Tashi stopped and looked out thoughtfully toward the horizon, a smile breaking out on his face.
What is it, Tashi? I asked. It's Ani and the rest of Shambhala, he said. They're linking with us. I can feel them.
He asked for everyone's attention. There's one more thing we can do. We can empower the angels in a general way to protect this valley. We followed along as Natalie led us through the process of setting a special field to flow out to the tops of the wooded ridges in all directions around the valley, and to empower the angels to protect us.
Visualize an angel being stationed on each ridge, she said. Shambhala was always protected. We can be protected too.
We all continued to focus on the mountains for several more minutes. Then the two youths began another intense conversation between themselves as we listened. They were talking about the other kids who had come through Shambhala, and the need for them to wake up, wherever they are. They told us that the kids coming in right now are more powerful than ever before. They're bigger, stronger, more intelligent in a whole new way. More are involved in extracurricular activities than ever before. They sing, dance, play a greater variety of sports, make music, write. More of them are developing their talents at an earlier age than was ever seen in previous generations. There's only one problem. The force of their expectation is much greater, but they haven't learned to fully monitor the effects of their thoughts yet. They can learn how the prayer fields work. We can help them. We watched as all the clerics began to walk toward Bill's house, along with Natalie and Tashi, who were still deeply engaged in conversation. A moment of skepticism swept over me. Even after all that I'd seen, I had my doubts that humans could really empower angels.
Do you really think we can summon angels to help ourselves and others? I asked Will. Would we be given that much power?
It's not that easy, he said. In fact, it is impossible for someone with negative intentions to attempt. None of this works unless we are fully connected within, with the energy of the Creator, and sending our energy very consciously out in front of us, touching others. If we have the slightest bit of ego involved or anger present, all the energy collapses and the angels can't respond. Do you see what I'm saying? We're God's agents on this planet. We can affirm and hold the vision of divine will, and if we authentically get in alignment with that positive future, we'll have enough prayer energy to direct the angels to act. I nodded, knowing he was right. Do you see what all this is? He asked. All this information, it's the 11th insight. The knowledge of the prayer fields takes human culture a step further. When we understood the 10th, the human purpose on this planet was to create an ideal spiritual culture by holding the vision, something was still missing. We didn't know how exactly to hold it. We didn't know the details of how to use our faith and expectation energetically. Now we know. The reality of Shambhala, the secret of prayer fields, has given us this. We can now hold the vision of a spiritual world and act to bring it about through our creative power. Human culture can't progress further until we consciously use this power in the service of spiritual evolution. We have to do as those in the temples were doing, methodically set our prayer field on all those key situations out there that will make the difference.
The true role of the media, especially television, is to point out these problem areas. We must notice every discussion, every scientific debate, every struggle someone is having between the dark and the light, and take the time to use our fields. He looked around. We can do this in small communities, churches, circles of friends all over the world. But what if the power of every religion was combined into one giant, unified prayer field? Right now, the field is fragmented, even canceled out by negative prayer and hatred. Good people are letting their thoughts add to evil, thinking it doesn't matter. But what if that changed? What if we set a field larger than the world has ever seen, sweeping across the planet to uplift those insidious forces everywhere who want to centralize power and control everyone else? What if every reform group in every profession and occupation knew how to do this? What if an awareness of the field spread that far? We'll pause for a moment. And what if we all really believed in the angelic realms, he continued, and knew that it was our birthright to empower them? There's no situation we couldn't immediately affect. The new millennium could look a lot different from how it is now. We would truly be the warriors of Shambhala, winning the battle over how the future will look. He stopped talking and looked at me very seriously. It is the true challenge of this generation. If we don't succeed, all the sacrifices of the past generations could be in vain. We might not get past the environmental damage that is occurring, or the insidious acts of the controllers. The important thing, Will continued, is to begin to build a conscious thought network to link the warriors together. Every person who knows has to connect with everyone else in their lives who would want to know. I was silent. What Will was saying made me think of Yin and all the others under the Chinese tyranny. What had happened to him? I wouldn't have made it without his help. I told Will what I was thinking. We can still find him, Will said. Television is only the precursor to perfecting your mind's eye, remember. Try to find an image of where he is. I nodded and tried to let my mind go blank, thinking only of Yin. Instead, the face of Colonel Chang appeared, and I recoiled. I told Will what had happened. Remember the look he had, Will said, when he seemed to be waking up, and find that expression in the image. I found that expression in my mind's eye, then suddenly the image shifted to Yin in a jail cell, surrounded by guards. I see Yin, I said, extending my prayer energy and empowering the higher realms until the scene grew lighter all around him. Then I visualized the light spreading to all those who were keeping him imprisoned. See an angel by Yin, Will said, and by the colonel. I nodded, thinking of the Tibetan code of compassion. Will raised an eyebrow and smiled as I concentrated again on the images. Yin would be safe. Tibet would eventually be free. This time, I had no doubt.
This has been a Time Warner Audiobooks production of The Secret of Shambhala, The Search for the 11th Insight, written by James Redfield and performed by LeVar Burton, also featuring an introduction read by the author. Produced and directed by Maya Thomas. Production coordinated by Daniel Metcalf. Tape edited, mixed, and mastered by Rick Dasher. The Secret of Shambhala, The Search for the 11th Insight, is also available in hardcover from Warner Books. Look for The Celestine Prophecy, The 10th Insight, and The Celestine Vision, also available from Time Warner Audiobooks. This book is a work of fiction, Names, characters, places, and incidents are either the product of the author's imagination or are used fictitiously, and any resemblance to actual persons, living or dead, events, or locales is entirely coincidental.